This is the story. The incredible story of an invincible American soldier who met an unbeatable enemy in disguise. And you'll hear another story. The amusing story of a boy who proved he'd be a great musician by hammering a piano to pieces. Yes, this is the story. As he moved silently from room to room that evening, closing the offices of the bank for the last time, the young clerk wore a sober and troubled expression. But it was not the problems of his famous and powerful employers that concerned him. After all, he had his own worries. From the moment that he'd seen the headlines in the morning papers screaming that the bank had failed, that one of its partners had been indicted as a thief and a swindler, from that moment, the clerk had known that he was out of a job, that he would have to start tramping the streets again in search of another one. And so now, as he took a last look around, all he felt was self-pity and a kind of slow, burning resentment. Who in the world, he wondered, had such rotten luck as he? And what had he done to deserve it? It was then that he opened the door to the innermost office. He paused on the threshold and uttered a low, astonished whistle. Why, he'd thought the bank was long since deserted. But there, sitting at his desk in silent despair, his head dropped forward on his chest, his hands clutching the arms of his chair, was one of the clerk's erstwhile employers. In that instant, all thought of himself vanished from the clerk's mind. He was consumed with pity of a different sort, with indignation that was deeper and stronger than resentment. He cleared his throat.
I beg your pardon, sir, but it's rather late, sir, and I'm closing up. Can I see you home, sir?
Apparently, the man at the desk didn't hear. He seemed lost in another, a remote and distant world. The world of the past, the clerk thought. Perhaps he was living over again the glory and the honor he had known, fighting once more the brilliant battles of a bygone day, feeling the thrill of power, the flesh of victory. It was incredible that he should have come to this, that he should be sitting here a broken and despondent man, he of all men on earth. Hesitantly, clerk stepped forward. Gingerly, he touched the slouching, almost lifeless figure on the shoulder. The old man glanced up. Old man? He could scarcely be more than 60, the clerk remembered, but he looked old, ages older. He smiled nervously, blinked his eyes, ran a trembling hand through his beard, and then he murmured,
Oh, yes. Yes, time to be going, eh? It's all over, isn't it? I suppose you read it in the papers, how he's been swindling me right along. And to think I had faith in him, my partner. Well, I know better now. I shall never trust another human being again.
The clerk stood frozen to the spot, watching the great man pull himself from his chair. To hear such words from those lips, that he would never trust another human being. He who had heard the cheers of a mighty nation ringing in his ears, who had received from a grateful people the highest tribute that was in their power to bestow. The old man spoke again, awkwardly, almost with embarrassment.
I don't imagine you've been giving your salary for this week, have you? I'd be glad to give it to you myself, but, I'm temporarily out of funds. Perhaps after my partner comes to trial...
The clerk fought back the tears that rose in his eyes. Temporarily out of funds. He knew what that meant. Destitute, poverty-stricken, hopelessly in debt, this man. It didn't matter, the clerk said quickly. He could get along without his week's salary. He was happy to have worked here for such an employer. It had been an honor to be associated with such an illustrious figure. If there was anything he could do to show his gratitude. But the great man stopped him with a wave of the hand, as if he... feared some expression of pity. He'd fallen low, he seemed to answer, but not low enough to be pitied. And then, straightening his shoulders, he shook the clerk's hand, and with the proud and martial bearing of an old soldier, no, of a general, a leader of soldiers, he left the bank. And thus, with that same bearing, that same stubborn pride, he walked along the streets of New York City towards his home. Not once did he seem to notice the glances that were cast in his direction, glances of mingled admiration and sympathy. Did they remember, these curious passers-by, that less than 20 years ago he had stood at the head of a triumphant army? Did they recall that just 5 years later, he had accepted a position of power that made him the equal of kings, a peer of potentates? And did they suspect that now he was penniless, ready to throw himself on public charity? Not until he had entered the private confines of his home did the old soldier allow his shoulders to slump beneath the burden of grief and failure. Now that he was alone again, he could but wait. He was not quite alone. There was someone waiting for him here. A stranger who had read the news and come rushing to visit him. A man whose face he had never seen before. Out of the shadows, the stranger stepped. And firmly, but with tact and grace, he informed the broken old man.
I have come here to assist you, sir. I have unlimited means at my disposal, and I am placing them at yours. You cannot refuse, because what I am offering you is neither a loan nor a gift. It is payment for services rendered to the country that I love. Services ending April 1865.
What his name was, this generous, patriotic stranger, will perhaps never be known. What is known, however, is that without his assistance, the old general might have lived out the remainder of his days in disgraceful want and misery. Disgraceful not to the general himself, for he was above disgrace, but to his fellow countrymen. For this broken man, swindled of his fortune and all but bereft of friends at the age of 60, had at the age of 43 accepted the unconditional surrender of the armies of the Confederacy at Appomattox Courthouse, and 3 years later at 46 had been elected President of the United States. Today his name ranks high among the noblest heroes of American history, the name of Ulysses S. Grant. This is the story. All the way from Busseto to Larancole, the piano tuner brooded on his wrongs and on the reward he would exact for them. The rain sliced against his face, the wind whipped past him, seizing the very breath from his mouth and carrying it away. Double his fee? Why, he ought to treble it. That's what he ought to do. And if he weren't such a kind-hearted man, that's what he would do. And then he reached the inn at Larancole. He heard from the innkeeper exactly why he had been brought out on such a day.
Ah, oh, you're just in time, Signor Cavaletti. If you come any later, my son, he wouldn't have been able to practice his lesson. You see, it's the boy's spinet that's broken, and he's wanting to play it.
Oh, so he was waiting to play it, was he? That infant that Stefan Cavaletti found in the music room, that ugly, undersized little 10-year-old, it was for him that the piano tuner had braved the storm. Controlling himself, Signor Cavaletti bent to his work. But in an instant, he had straightened up again, his face red with rage, his eyes blazing. Angrily, he thundered,
"How can anyone repair a spinet in such a condition as it is, huh? Why, it has been ruined. It looks as if it had been smashed with a hammer."
It was then that the 10-year-old child spoke up in a tone that was simple and clear and wholly unafraid. He announced that it had been smashed with a hammer. Yes, it had. And that he himself, who had smashed it just a few hours before.
Oh, you did you? And for that, I had to ride 3 miles in the rain. Well, your father, he will pay for it, my young friend. Now he will pay me 4 times my regular fee. Do you hear me? Huh? 4 times. Because you don't like to practice your lessons.
Oh, but he did like to, the child assured the piano tuner. Signor Cavaletti misunderstood. He had smashed it only because he was angry at himself, angry at the clumsiness of his playing, angry because his tiny fingers would not stretch far enough to play the beautiful chords he so longed to play. Somewhat mollified, Signor Cavaletti began to work at the spinet. And as he worked, the child standing beside him continued to talk. He spoke of how he loved music, of how he hoped someday to be a great musician, perhaps even a great composer. Now and then, the piano tuner's eyes would rest on him, and there was no anger in them now. There was only a gentle admiration, something almost akin to a fatherly pride. At last, the spinet was repaired, and the child sat down to play for the piano tuner. And for a long time, the piano tuner listened and was strangely silent. And when he left the innkeeper saw him to the door. How much did he owe him, he asked. What was his charge for being brought out on this rainy day? To which, with a blush and lowered eyes, Stefan Cavaletti replied,
Nothing, senor. You owe me nothing at all. It was an honor to
to be permitted to repair that spinet for your son.
Today, in a museum in the little village of Larancole, in Italy, that same spinet still stands. On a piece of paper pasted inside it may be read this message. I, Stefan Cavaletti, piano tuner, have repaired this spinet free of charge. The talent of the innkeeper's son and his love for the instrument were more than a sufficient reward for my labor. Thus it was the piano tuner of Busseto, who was the first to recognize the genius of the child who was someday to compose such beloved operas as Aida, Otello, and Il Trovatore, the child who bore the immortal name of Giuseppe Verdi. Yes, this is the story.